I do want to most of you, but I do want to say how delighted I am to, first of all, having met you, the opportunity to meet you tonight after exchanging emails and tracking down mutual friends, you know, for years. And it's just been, you know, such an honor to break bread with you and to have a wonderful conversation at dinner. Secondly, I would just like to say that, you know, when I began thinking about the project on Lit Theology 15 years ago, or trying to create some initiative that would build bridges between the academic study of religion and work going on at the grassroots, it was precisely the work of such folks as Perry Perkins that inspired me to conceptualize this and then begin trying to develop a team of fundraisers and collaborators. To me, it's, you know, looking at this story and at the extraordinary work you've done, the fearless, courageous, you know, visionary work you've done in organizing over several decades in Louisiana, you know, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, out of in your own story, a kind of you know, faith journey. It's that story that offers so many important lessons in the way scholars think about not only the possibilities of the academic vocation, but really the way we frame and organize our research, and the way we imagine our audiences, and the way we think about our reading list and the curriculum. And so I am, first of all, grateful to you for pausing from your incredibly busy schedule to share some thoughts with us tonight, but more importantly, grateful for your witness and for your work. I can offer a long introduction. I'll say something kind of funny. I was we're having dinner a few minutes ago at Camino's downtown, and the waitress came up, and I said, you know, we have not a long time to eat. We have to be out of here at 7 o'clock because, you know, we have a very distinguished guest here tonight. Perry Perkins is one of, you know, sort of our great national treasures, veritable national treasure. You know, one of the legendary organizers in America. In fact, he taught Barack Obama everything he knows about, you know, the work of organizing. And then Perry actually starts telling a story about having President Obama in one of the organizing sessions 20 years ago, and the worry among you and Cortez and others that you might lose this talented young man to another career. You know, he's going and running for office someday, I think, is what you said. We have many things in common, but I'd like to say Perry Perkins is sort of a regional southern director of the Industrial Areas Foundation. Some of you may have been involved in IAF work here in the Charlottesville, Virginia area through the Virginia Organizing Project. I know some of you have already introduced yourself. You're going to talk about your journey, about the whole notion of organizing, about what it might mean to think of community organizing as a spiritual discipline. And we also have many, as it turns out, family and friend connections. So I really am happy to have you here. This has been formal. You know, we look forward to, you know, a Q&A after you share your words, your thoughts. You know, it wasn't until last week that I realized, though, how much you are present in a lot of the secondary scholarly literature that's been written over the past 10 years about faith-based organizing, community organizing, and particularly organizing from an institutional kind of context. And then I recall a book I read some years ago. It's a wonderful book by, who was a sociologist at Harvard University at the time, Mark Warren. I think he's now at UMass Boston, called Dry Bones Rattling, Community Building to Revitalize American Democracy. It's a terrific book. Princeton published this. I'll pass it around. And here you are. You're everywhere in this book. And now Warren has a new book called Fire in the Heart, our newish book, How White Liberals Embrace Racial Justice, with a beautiful profile of your work and sort of, you know, a kind of testimonial of sorts that appears. So we are grateful to have you here. And what we'll do is we'll have, you know, 30 minutes or so of your meditations and reflections, and then some Q&A, and then we'll break in about, you know, an hour and have some more beverages and some more time of informal conversation. So Patricia is here. Patricia Perkins is here, Perry's wife, and then Melissa, who's been part of the project events over the past several years, who I guess you guys are friends from high school in Mississippi. So welcome to you,
and
welcome back to Charlottesville. So it's all yours. We look forward to this, and thanks for being here.
So much for Alinsky. Saul Alinsky, who founded the Industrial Areas Foundation, used to talk about the passion for anonymity. And, you know, organizers, at least the way I practice it, you know, I don't care who knows me. You know, I'm going to take this off.
Yeah.
You know,
we can always open some doors.
Oh, no, I'm fine. And I also want to introduce another friend. Martin Trimble is my colleague here in Virginia with the Industrial Areas Foundation. And Martin has kindly come down to be here with us tonight. So if you have any really questions, serious about organizing, ask Martin. Normally when I do something like this, I don't read a text. But I'm going to tonight because Charles, and I'll tell the story in a minute, Charles gave me an assignment, and so and it's 3 years overdue, and so you students know how that goes. But I'm not trying to, I'm really trying to tell a story of my own personal story of faith and how organizing really provides me a way to know God and a way to interact with the world. And so I'm not, you know, I'll talk about organizing from that perspective, but not going to give you like a lot of organizing war stories. And be glad to do that in the question and answer. And one other disclaimer, I did not train President Obama. I was not even at the training that he was at. But he did come to our national training in 1988 at Mount St. Mary's College in Los Angeles. And really the word was that we were trying to steal him from another network of organizers. And several people, Arnie Graf and Ernesto Cortez, had the job of kind of working with him, and they would meet with him at night after the sessions, and they said, well, we think we've got him away from the other network, but he's probably going to go to law school and run for something. And so, I don't claim that. I may claim it later, you know. A number of years ago, I read the book, Charles's first book, God's Long Hot Summer. His book about Freedom Summer in 1964 in my native state of Mississippi. He wrote about the summer from the perspective of four participants, and I knew two of them. One was Ed King, who was the white chaplain at Tougaloo College in Mississippi and was the 1963 candidate for governor on the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party ticket that was actually not an official ticket, but was an attempt to say, look, over 70,000 black folks who could not vote registered to vote for that ticket. And then I knew Dr. Douglas Hudgens, who was the pastor of First Baptist Church Jackson, and Charles in his book calls him the chaplain for segregation, right? Something
like
that.
Unofficial chaplain of the White Citizens Council.
and absolutely he was. But I also knew Charles's father, who, like mine, had been a pastor in Mississippi during those tumultuous days. And later I came to know that I had grown up reading articles by Ken Toler, the Jackson Bureau chief of the Memphis Commercial Appeal, who was Charles's grandfather. And after reading this book, I did not come in contact with Charles and his work for a few more years. But one night, I was channel surfing, and I saw Charles on C-SPAN. And he was making a presentation about his most recent book. I went out and purchased Dark Days and was struck by the pale of fear that he described coming into the life of his family when they moved to Laurel, Mississippi in 1967. He recounts a fear in the house, in the community, that had not existed in Alabama. Mississippi, Alabama, you know. But as I read this description, I recognized the story. It was a familiar one, not because I knew Charles at the time, but his experience of coming to Mississippi in 1967 was familiar because I was the son of a Mississippi Baptist pastor, and I had experienced the same kind of fear much earlier than Charles because I was born in Mississippi. After I read this book, I contacted Charles, and then later on I read your book on the Christian right, on Christian soldiers. And again, I contacted Charles and was telling him about being a son of a Mississippi Baptist pastor and was an organizer with the Industrial Areas Foundation. He said, well, you know, somebody ought to write about organizing as a spiritual discipline. And so I've been kind of working at it for 3 years. And Charles, this is still very preliminary and provisional, all right? But tonight I'm going to give kind of my take on what I've learned as about organizing. And so, Professor Marsh, I hope I won't get an incomplete. But now, Southerners are storytellers, and my father was a storyteller. He loved to tell stories in his sermons. So I'm going to begin with a story, and it's a story I've told, but it's not one that I have read, and it's frankly it's an emotional story for me. Let me begin with a story that's central to my theological and political formation, and is the motivation that led me to the vocation of organizing. I call this story "Lessons from the Dark Room." I remember the dark room. I did not know what was in it, but I do remember it was my parents' bedroom. This room was in what we children refer to as the old house, the parsonage of First Baptist Church West Point, where my father was pastor. West Point was a small town in northeast Mississippi of about 10,000 residents. Approximately 50% were black and 50% white. In the early 50s, when the story occurred, the town was deeply segregated and divided. The dark room stands out in my earliest memories. The memories were not vivid in terms of detail, but the emotions and feelings associated with them are still fresh and palpable. The dark room was the place where the secret wisdom of the adults were imparted to me and my sister. It was a wisdom that would teach me how to interact and navigate with the world beyond the old house. The conversations were serious and somber. I don't remember having babysitters often, but this night there was an important meeting at the church. Both of my parents had to be there. Beth was 4 years older than me and was not old enough to stay with us at night, so Mrs. Annie Harrison came over to stay with us. Mrs. Harrison was short and stocky and a very dark-skinned woman. She was pleasant and extremely courteous, but as I remember, was not overly deferential as most African Americans of that era were expected to act toward white people. We called her Mrs. Harrison, not by her first name as most white children did. I don't remember much about being told how to address Mrs. Harrison. I just remember that was the rule, and others of my friends thought it strange. The night began quite uneventfully. My mom gave me a kiss on the cheek and told me to be good and to obey Ms. Harrison. That she needed to do that. These were days before we had TV in the house, so Beth and I played a board game. Miss Harrison told me it was time to take a bath and begin to get ready. I began to get ready for bed. I don't know what provoked me, but words just came out of my mouth. These were words that I had often heard from adults in the world beyond the old house, though never from my parents. You cannot make me take a bath. I don't have to listen to you. You're just an old nigger. The look on Miss Harrison's face was one of extreme hurt. She remained calm, but the hurt look never left her face. 58 years later, the look still haunts me. I see the shock on her face and the hurt. The hurt cuts through my spirit today, but it did not stop me that night. I don't remember the details of what happened after that, but I can hear the voice of my sister. Perky, you know, we don't talk like that. I'm going to tell Mama, and when she gets home, you're going to get a whipping. The thought of a whipping stopped me in my tracks, but I didn't apologize. I just went to my room and cried and waited for my mom's return. Miss Harrison came into the room to check on me, but didn't utter a word. Her silence made the anticipation of the return of my mother more intense. Then I heard the car pulling up, and I realized that it was not my mother I needed to worry about. It was my father. I knew he would be angry, and I began to cry hard. I heard the back door open, and Beth went running. Beth was a tattletale. During our growing up, she reveled in telling on my many transgressions. I would hear her loud, excited voice. I knew it was coming. I heard my father's voice and the door opening in the same instant. Perk, you better come out here right now and apologize. You know that we don't call anyone by that name in this house. You tell Miss Harrison that you're sorry. The tears were coming hard and I could hardly speak. I was ashamed at what I said, but I was more afraid of the wrath of my father than anything else. Miss Harrison, I'm sorry for what I said. Then the tears almost uncontrollably came over me, and I guess she accepted the apology. I was left with my dad and his wrath. He did not administer corporal punishment often, but that night he did. After my punishment, my parents and I were in the dark room together. I sat on the bed, my dad sat in the chair, and my mom sat down on the bed next to me. She lightly touched my head and I saw the concern on her face. But I also saw her love. My fear was no longer as intense until I looked at my father's face. His wrinkled brow was even more wrinkled, and the broad public smile was nowhere to be found. His gravelly baritone voice was stern, as it always was when he scolded me. By this time, the voice was even more serious. I knew from the top of my head to the bottom of my feet and deep into my soul, this was going to be a serious talk. I'd stopped crying by this point and looked at him fearfully and expectantly. I'm ashamed of you. Your mother and I have taught you and your sister better than that. Again, I know this was not just another "your mother and I have taught you better than that" talk. His voice was stern and still angry, but his love and seriousness were penetrating the usual stern demeanor and the anger that I had always feared. The Bible teaches us, I remember saying to myself, oh no, not the Bible teaches us talk. But again, this was no ordinary talk. His words came clearly, but the stern tone gave way to a kind of moral clarity that was my dad's hallmark. His teaching that night in the dark room was a moral and political teaching that has guided my life for 50-something years since that night. The teaching is at the center of my work and my spirit, but it is also at the center of my anger. My father taught me that we're all created in the likeness and image of God. He said that this means that we're all equal, black and white, no better than the other, all equal in the eyes of God. The teaching did not stop there. He told me, without using the terms, that scripture had political implications. He told me that our creation meant that segregation was wrong. His clarity on this point penetrated my young mind. My fear had receded, and I was listening in awe and quiet wonder at his words. He went on, segregation is wrong, and it is going away. There will be a time in this town, this state, in this country, where white people and Negroes will live side by side, go to school together, and treat each other equally as God intends. I had not seen fear come into the room. My dad's moral clarity and theological teaching had seemed to keep him at bay. But he came in. He entered the room as my father kept talking. Segregation is wrong. It is evil. It is going away. But there's not much we can do to hasten its demise. My dad's moral certainty and theological strength had given way to fear. I didn't know this at the time. I thought he had spoken these words with one voice and one spirit. But looking back, I know that he spoke with two voices. One was the clarity of the biblical prophets. The other voice was the voice of the evil one. Some call him the devil, others Satan, but I knew him as fear. Fear spoke, but not in an audible voice. He didn't have to speak. He didn't have to. My dad spoke for him. Do you understand what I'm saying? I nodded my assent. He continued, we have to be careful who we tell this to. Not everyone thinks as we do, so you must be careful. Fear smiled and left the room, but his spirit remained. Over the years, I wrestled with these conflicting teachings. My increased determination not to live in a world where this kind of fear was promoted in order to maintain a social order drew me more deeply into organizing. However, it has been melding of the IF disciplines of planning, acting, and reflecting on action with the spiritual disciplines of daily journaling, interior dialogue, and prayer that has begun to give me very concrete victories over the demons of inherited fear that I met for the first time in that dark room in segregated West Point, Mississippi. My father spoke with two conflicting voices because he felt powerless. He knew deep down that the social system that was based on white supremacy was in direct conflict with biblical teachings that he and his congregation claimed to follow. He knew all too clearly that the biblical teachings that we're created in the likeness and image of God wages an attack on white supremacy. Yet the fear within him left him conflicted and speaking with two voices. I inherited this fear. The last story I want to tell, was shortly after it was published, I read Charles Payne's I've Got the Light of Freedom, the organizing tradition in the Mississippi freedom struggle. I was deeply moved by this book. It chronicles the day-to-day work of unknown heroes of the struggle. And it tells the story of the tension between the organizing work of these heroes like Amzie Moore and Doc Henry and Medgar Evers, and the better-known story of the mass movement and direct action personified by Dr. King. It had a deep impact on my thinking and on my thinking about organizing. But it was in my second reading of this book while preparing for an IAF organizer and leader seminar with Dr. Payne that I had an epiphany. The first chapter of the book, if you read it, is a litany of murders, lynchings, and acts of violence against African Americans in Mississippi in the years of the last century leading up to the Civil Rights Movement. Came upon a paragraph that told the story of five lynchings that occurred in Lowndes County, Mississippi, in 5 mile radius of where my father lived between the ages of 5 and 16. I finally knew where his fear came from. He knew something that I did not know. He knew that segregation was built on the foundation of violence and intimidation, not just against black folk, but also against anyone who might be willing to question the prevailing ideology. He did not simply have an intellectual understanding of this political reality. His spirit was baptized in the violence, intimidation, and fear deliberately created to maintain that system. In that dark room, I was baptized into that spirit. I knew from the earliest moments that if faith was to be real in my life and real in the world around me, that I had to find a spirituality that gave me a new baptism. Organizing has been central to the development of spirituality that breaks free from the one I met in the dark room. If spiritual disciplines are a pathway to a deeper relationship with God and the world, then I believe there are practices of organizing that I've learned from my over 30 years experience in organizing, 28 years with IAF, that truly are spiritual disciplines. I want to lift up three universals. The first that I think are important to my spiritual development. First is the radical commitment to relational power. Second is the public dealing with grief and loss. And third is action reflected upon. Early in my organizing career with the IAF, I was introduced to an article by Bernard Loomer called Two Kinds of Power. In this article, Dr. Loomer says that most of us have only experienced one kind of power, the power that I experienced in Mississippi. Unilateral power. Our experience with power is where one person has all the power and they make all the decisions. Often this kind of power proves the point of Lord Acton's famous dictum. What did Lord Acton say about power? This is a test.
Corrupts.
Power corrupts.
Absolutely.
What he says is power corrupts. Tends to corrupt. And absolute power corrupts absolute. In the question that somebody asked me in the question, there's a great story about that. We'll go back to you later. Loomer says there was another type of power, relational power. Relational power is built by multiple parties and exercised with, not on the participants. My experience of growing up was the abuse of power. And unilateral power built by intimidation and violence. Through Loomer and in my relationship to the colleagues, men and women of the IAF network and leaders, I learned of a power that was transformational. I saw poor people with little formal education and people of means with the best education and money worked together to build the capacity to change their institutions and their communities. If that's not spiritual, then I don't understand the term. Our organizing is about building power, the capacity to act. But in IAF, I found that relationships built in organizing of money and people, that the relationships are integral to the process. Our organizing is about creating inside communities such as churches, synagogues, mosques, local labor unions, neighborhood associations, and local nonprofits, a deep practice of relationality. A practice that seeks to not simply understand the issue a person cares about, but the personal story that shapes their willingness to act. There are two relational tools that we teach. First is the relational meeting. And second are house meetings. Both tools are about a search for leaders and what they're interested in acting upon. Taken mechanically or for pure utilitarian purposes, they could become very transactional, with the relational meeting becoming a sterile interview. And the public gathering of leaders we call house meetings could become, God forbid, a focus group. For me, relational meetings and house meetings are not about a listing of possible issues for action, but about a mixing of spirits. And the mixing of spirits that creates a new personal imagination for what I can do, an institutional imagination, and a new social imagination. Let me relate another story that kind of makes this point. A number of years ago, I was working in Beaumont, Texas, and there was a very prominent pastor in that community, Reverend Ovil Walker. He's pastor of Concord Missionary Baptist Church. And he was deeply involved in the life of that community, and his denominational and community commitments drew him all over the place. But there was one thing that he was more committed to than anything else, and that was public education. In fact, one pastor said that when he moved to town, he thought Reverend Walker was not a pastor, but that he worked for the school district. One day, sitting in his office, I asked him why he was so involved in these issues. He said, "My father had a fifth grade education and was a successful small businessman, and he did not value education. And he forbade me to go to college. And he said, I did. And when my sisters graduated from high school, I rebelled against my father and paid for their way to college. Then I went to college and went on to seminary. I do not want to see any child in this town have to go through what I went through." At that moment, I had a deeper insight into the interests and concerns and motivation of Reverend Walker, but more importantly, there was a mixing of spirits. I told him a version of the story from the dark room. Our relationship deepened, and there was a quality to our work that didn't exist before my understanding of that story. Spiritual disciplines are pathway to our listening to God's voice in our lives. The relational meeting and house meetings allow us to enter into a conversation where we begin to forget our next question and listen deeply to the pain, the struggle, the loss, the victories, the joys of others in our institutions and communities. David Tracy says that conversation requires us to give ourselves over to the movement of the conversation. We get beyond our concerns and ourselves, and we can begin to experience the lives of leaders that we want to act together with. Again, if this isn't spiritual, I don't know what is. For me, this mixing of spirit allows me to see God in the stories of others and to find God's redemption in my own story. In the IAF canon, We do this training called Qualities of Leaders, and we're trying to teach about the qualities that you look for in a leader. And invariably, you know, we ask, at least when I used to do it, I don't know if I do it anymore, but we'll say, "Who has all these qualities?" And one time this lady says, "Jesus." And I said, "But you're not Jesus." And so we look for a collective of leaders that have these qualities. And the first quality that most of us look for is anger. And anger's gotten a bad rap.
Aren't you single?
Well, maybe.
No.
Our English word for anger comes from the Norse word ange, which means grief and loss. All of us experience grief and loss in our lives. It is a part of the human condition. All of us have experiences where we are impacted by grief. The question is, what do we do with it? One response to grief is apathy, where we feel so powerless that we don't think we can do anything, and we don't. Another experience to grief is rage. And we see that played out in our communities all across the country where young men and women are taking out the rage that is built up from the grief in their lives. But neither of those two responses are anger. Anger's in between. In his Daily Study Bible, William Barclay says that the word translated into English as meek is misunderstood. The Greek word is praus. And that Aristotle describes praus as the means between two extremes. And Aristotle describes meekness as the medium between excessive anger and angerlessness. Barclay says the better translation is, blessed is the one who is always angry at the right time and never angry at the wrong time. Reverend Walker had an appropriate response to the grief in his life. He did not lash out at his father. He first responded by sending his sisters to college. And then he went to college. Thank you. And then he went to college, but more importantly, he committed himself that no child in Beaumont would have to live that way because there was a community that valued education. Through the process of organizing, I came to understand that much of what brought me to organizing was the experience that I had in that dark room. My anger drew me into organizing. Growing up, I felt powerless. I knew that segregation was wrong, but I wanted to be a part of bringing about that change. I did not want to leave it up to God. Public action, or exercising my own agency and teaching others to act and reflecting upon our cooperative action has gotten me beyond my inheritance of fear. In fact, it has brought me to a vibrant and joyful encounter with God through those I act with. I think this is the last story. Early in my career with IAF, in a meeting with a priest in inner city Houston, I noticed that he seemed depressed and dispirited. I asked him, "Father Bill, what's bothering you?" He told me that a teacher at his school had been stabbed and robbed at knife point, and the same thing had happened at the public school right behind him, and the same thing had happened at the Episcopal school down the street. This problem is only going to get worse, and there is nothing we can do about it. It is all coming from, there was this club across the street that had been a private club, and he said the owners of that club have friends in high places, and we'll never be able to stop this. I was a young organizer, and fear came into me. However, I knew this was not a time for fear and not a time for timidity. Father, we can do something about it. We are not powerless. Our organization has 60 member institutions, and many of them are in this community. We can harness that power, select the right targets, to put pressure on, and we can solve this problem. He was a bit skeptical, but his desperation was giving way to some hope that we might be successful. Father, there's one more thing. You are going to have to be at the center of this action. I knew that this was the last thing he wanted to hear. He supported our organizing work, but I had a deal with him. He would encourage the leaders, and he did not have to be at the active center of the work. I knew, however, that in this case, going up against some very entrenched powers, that the local clergy would need to be out front. And if Father Bill was not out front, we would not get other pastors involved. We would not be successful without him. He looked at me very reluctantly and gave his assent. The campaign to rid the community of this source of violence was highly successful. Not only did we close down the drug house, we closed down every known drug house for 5 square miles. From our leaders' research came the first use of the federal racketeering statutes to seize property used in drug crimes. There was numerous action, small with local police captains, the city council member, police chief, the district attorney, the U.S. attorney, and the mayor. There were 2 large public actions of over 1,000 leaders at each event. All along the way, Father kept his word. At times he wanted to back out and he wanted to call it off, but he kept his word. During the campaign, I became deeply aware that Father's reason for not wanting to be at the center of the action was the inherited fear in his own life. It wasn't what he told me, that he was just too busy. But it was the fear that he had been taught by his parents. At the Mass where we celebrated the victories of the campaign, the priest stood and declared that the real victory of this effort was not simply ridding the community of this source of violence or pioneering new tools and taking our neighborhood back from drug dealers. For him, the spiritual victory over fear inside of him had given way to joy and strength through action. In action, I have seen God at work, he said. In action through our organizing, I have been set free. His clarity about what was happening to his spirit was not an accident. It is our practice after every action, large or small, to have an evaluation. In the evaluation, we look at how we executed our plan. We look at what was the reaction from our target of the action. We look at how we moved the issue. But we also ask questions about the development of leaders and what leaders are learning about themselves. It was through this practice that Father Bill was more clearly confronted by his fear. It was also in these evaluations that he saw that the spiritual power that is released through collective action. In one such evaluation, after a hard meeting with the mayor, he said, "I am learning what it means to have dominion over creation. Through our action, we are truly beginning to be God's co-creators, creating a new community in this forgotten part of the city." If you go back to that neighborhood now, it is not a forgotten part of the city anymore. The victories of this campaign were important, but the lasting contribution in the transformation of this pastor, other leaders in this parish were frankly as important or more important. The day before my mother died, I had a conversation with her that would be my last conversation. And in response to a political problem that I was working through that had deep implications for a new project that I was developing, she said, "You're not anxious." about this situation, Arnie. You're not afraid. I have broken the hold of the one that I met in the dark room many years ago. My discovery of God and God's power in the world has come through the development of daily internal spiritual disciplines, but has also come through the discipline of building power relationally, acting with the appropriate anger, and collectively reflecting on our experiences. Professor Marsh, I think I have completed the first part of my assignment, but I hope this chapter adds to our mutual quest for a lived theology.
Huh. Thank you.
Thank you.